George Bernard Shaw is reputed to have said that Great Britain and the United States are separated by a common language. Perhaps nothing could have pleased Noah Webster more. His spelling book and dictionary were designed to unify the new nation by making its language uniform, and to secure American independence by making America's English distinct from Britain's. As my guest Joe Lepore has discovered, Webster was far from alone in his belief in the power of language to either unite people or divide them. Joe Lepore is a professor of history at Boston University and the author of A is for American, Letters and Other Characters in the Newly United States. Professor Lepore, welcome.
Thank you.
In the 1780s, Noah Webster declared that a national language was necessary to unify the country. How was that supposed to work?
Well, Webster really came of age in the 1780s at the same time as the nation did. And he, like the United States, was kind of casting about for a way of understanding himself. And he really tied his career to that of the country. And like many Americans of his generation, he graduated from college in the late 1780s, in the 1770s, he felt that he ought to contribute something to the building and fortification, really, of the United States. And he felt that one of the things the United States most lacked was a distinctive national character. As a nation that had just declared its independence and fought a war over that independence from a mother country with which it shared many common values and fashions and a common language, Webster felt that the United States needed to really kind of almost artificially and deliberately and very self-consciously introduce national distinctions between itself and England so that the United States would be different from England and so that Americans would feel themselves to have more in common with one another than they did with their cousins across the Atlantic. And one of those differences, he thought, that could be most fully articulated was a difference in language. And he, unlike some of his compatriots, felt that there was no way to abolish English, that we were stuck with English. English was going to be our national language, and we had it was just impractical to adopt a different national language. But he wanted to introduce distinctions into the language that would help English evolve into what he called the American language, so that he hoped that over generations and through careful cultivation, American and English would be as different from one another as Spanish and Portuguese, say. So how would this work? Well, I guess, first of all, for Webster, it would be through changing the way we spell. And these would be small changes, but that they would underscore changes in pronunciation that would celebrate a distinctive American way of speaking and would help take these small steps towards the gradual differentiation of the languages.
So Webster believes that spelling is patriotic. My 10-year-old daughter, I asked her about this last night, does not think so. Who's right? Would you care to arbitrate that dispute?
Well, spelling can be very political. That its politics is a patriotic one is something that Webster would have claimed, but I think I might be able to convince your 10-year-old daughter, given enough time and enough Oreo cookies, that there is something political about the way that we spell, and that spelling and how we spell is a marker of who we are, that we tend to make assumptions about people based on how they spell, whether they're educated or not educated. And certainly in Webster's lifetime, when spelling was much more erratic and idiosyncratic, we would be able to make more assumptions about people. Webster felt that English spelling was crazy. And we all know that English spelling is crazy. This is something that George Bernard Shaw was wont to point out. And a lot of spelling reformers interested in standardizing English spelling over the years have been careful to point out that English spelling is crazy. Webster thought that simplifying spelling wasn't really the main answer, though. He disagreed with people like Benjamin Franklin, who wanted to rationalize spelling by changing the alphabet. Webster just wanted to make spelling different, make American spelling different from English spelling, so that you'd be able to immediately recognize at a glance whether a writer was English or British, which to some degree we can now do because of Webster's work, that the British spell honor with a U and we do not is something that Webster introduced and really codified. It was just a local variant, but Webster codified it in his dictionary and his spelling books and insisted that people, that Americans spell honor without the U. That kind of thing is something that Webster introduced. So he wanted many more innovations than those in American spelling, but the few that do exist that are markers really of national origins are Websterian.
Some of the words that he wanted to spell in different ways were even crazier, I think, than the original ones. I translate some of the Webster versions of words as I was reading your book. His name lives on, of course, as a name on a spine or on a cover, usually of a dictionary. Is it possible historically to assess his actual significance?
I think it's pretty difficult to assess his actual significance. There are a lot of claims thrown out there about, most of which I actually am somewhat persuaded by, that one of the things that Webster is most responsible for is for homogenizing American speech. I'm not sure how carefully we could reconstruct that process, but it seems to be true that maybe by the middle of the 19th century, it was quite commonplace for British travelers to the United States to remark with some astonishment on the fact that you could travel from Boston to Charlestown, South Carolina, and you would hear what sounded to Europeans, to Englishmen, like the same language. Very much, very similar speech. We might be very conscious of those distinctions. We might think a Bostonian speaks very different from someone from South Carolina. But from an English point of view, those two kinds of speech are very similar, as compared to, say, London and a Yorkshireman, a Londoner and a Yorkshireman. So Englishmen and women who traveled to the United States were always making this observation that Americans tended to speak much like one another and much more closely like one another than people living in a much smaller place in England did. And this most historians would attribute to Webster, and especially to his spelling book, where he felt that what he was doing was teaching a standard spelling that would have the effect of homogenizing pronunciation. And to some considerable degree did do that.
The 18th and 19th century United States included several thousand Indians for whom English was not the first language, if indeed they spoke it at all. One of them, Sequoia, developed a written language for his people for reasons not entirely unlike Webster's.
Well, there were, during Webster's lifetime, a lot of people who were involved in spelling reform. There are people like Webster who want to change the way the English language is spelled to simplify or standardize spelling. Webster wanted to nationalize spelling. But there's another group of people in the late 18th and 19th century who were interested in standardizing spelling in order to missionize, to Christianize Indian people and also to Christianize Africans and all these missionary movements that are on the ascendancy in the 19th century. Work with linguists and philologists to come up with ways to write down Native American languages, for instance, so that they can print Bibles in Native American languages, so that they can more readily convert Native peoples to Christianity. So there's a lot of missionary work that is involved with thinking about standard spelling, new kinds of alphabets, how to standardize an alphabet, how to develop a universal alphabet. And this is all simultaneous to the work that Webster is doing, which goes in a very different direction. Webster wants to nationalize and particularize spelling. These missionaries want to universalize spelling so that they could have a single, what this is a precursor really of the International Phonetic Alphabet. These missionaries are trying to devise such a thing so that they can print Bibles in all the world's languages using a single set of printing characters. There's some resistance to this, considerable resistance to this, especially among the Cherokee people, people who want to resist Christianization, some of them, and resist assimilation. And one man who's involved in resisting assimilation is this Cherokee silversmith named Sequoia, who decides that he doesn't think it's the right thing for his people to learn to read and write English or Cherokee using the Roman alphabet, but that he thinks if he simply applies his intellect to it, he could figure out how to invent a writing system for his own people. Sequoia couldn't read or write English. He couldn't speak English either. He just had some idea what the alphabet was supposed to do. He knew that it meant that people could look at something on a page and read it. And so he spent a decade of his life basically mulling over the question and kind of recapitulating the evolution of writing. He started off with ideographs and went to logographs, and ended up with a set of 85 characters, which he finalized in 1821, one character for every syllable of the Cherokee language. And he brought this invention to the Cherokee National Council, and they approved of it, had commissioned a printing press built with fonts in these 85 characters, and sort of almost overnight, half the Cherokee Nation learned to read in this new set of characters. And what's so parallel, I mean, Sequoyah and Webster are near exact contemporaries, but their work is so parallel in that they're both resisting what is really more the dominant movement of their era, which is the universalizing of writing systems, or kind of, you might say, sort of an imperializing of writing systems, of taking the Roman alphabet and using it for all the world's languages. Sequoyah said no. You know, Sequoyah was essentially inventing and promoting a national alphabet, much the way Webster was promoting a national spelling.
What's interesting is these drives go so many different ways, that there are forces that tend toward unification, and others, as you've mentioned, that lead to distinct differences, to nationalism. One of the things that was most powerful in seemingly uniting people were the technological advances like the telegraph, Morse's code in particular. What was the impact of the telegraph in the United States? How was it received in the 19th century?
Well, the telegraph was hailed as an invention that would help bind the nation together. It was certainly promoted that way, and in many places it was hailed in that way. You have to remember, by the time the telegraph is invented in 1844, the United States is on the verge of war with Mexico in an attempt to annex new territories for westward expansion, and is already struggling with the problem of westward expansion and the question of whether slavery will be allowed to exist in these new western territories as they become part of the Union. So the nation is vexed with the question of this fundamental divide in the nation between slave states and free states, and it is going to be held in the grip of this question all the way to the end of the Civil War. And so Americans are pretty obsessed with the problem of how this growing, now sprawling nation seems to be fragmenting and seems to be essentially bifurcated over the question of slavery. The telegraph is hailed as an invention that will help bind this nation together. It will make us one people, is the kind of thing. It will make one neighborhood out of our people, is the kind of thing that Morse would say. And as in the 1850s, the Atlantic cable is being constructed to unite the United States and Europe by telegraph, that rhetoric is expanded to kind of proto-globalism. You know, this transmission of information so rapidly across these wires will make us make a single neighborhood of the whole world. A lot of that rhetoric sounds a lot like some of the early kind of naive internet rhetoric that we heard in the late 80s and early 90s. But there's a particular political question that the telegraph is applied to in the 1840s and 1850s, and that's the problem of sectionalism.
Your book is filled with ironies. The telegraph and the telephone linked people and nations together as never before, and yet that was something that neither Samuel Morse nor Alexander Graham Bell seemed to have wanted. One was a nativist and a conspiracy theorist, thought the Catholics were coming to get us. The other was a supporter of selective racial breeding and genetics.
Yeah, I originally wasn't going to write about Morse or about Bell, and I kind of stumbled onto them and then became really interested in them, in particular because they're both married to deaf women. And so was another character who was always part of my project, Thomas Hopkins Gallaudet, the deaf educator, not a deaf man, but an educator of the deaf, the founder of the first American school for the deaf in 1817. And Gallaudet was also married to a deaf woman. And I just became really puzzled by why these three people who valued communication were all married to deaf women, and what it was about the world of the deaf and the world of inventors of communication devices that seemed to intersect. Gallaudet, it's understood, he married one of his students, and it makes perfect sense, and he was fluent in sign language and spoke with his profoundly deaf wife, communicated with his profoundly deaf wife through sign language, and this was just part of his world and part of his commitment. Morse married a deaf woman after he had invented the telegraph, but reflected to some degree, reflected his ideas about women and his yearning for an especially dependent spouse. Alexander Graham Bell married a former student of his, and Bell was in fact a deaf educator before he became an inventor of telegraphic and telephonic apparatus. But I became really interested in the question of deafness, and in a special irony in Morse's case, of his near complete isolation from the world of his peers over the course of his lifetime. Because Morse started out inventing the telegraph in the 1830s at a time when he was convinced that there was an international conspiracy to overthrow the United States government led by the Pope, to immigrate, to send Irish and German Catholics to the United States to undermine American democracy. He was a very ardent nativist who opposed basically any European immigration. He wanted to extend naturalization, you know, 14 years, who wanted foreign-born Americans to never have the right to vote, for instance. And there's, I think, some evidence that he invented the telegraph in order to combat this conspiracy, that initially the telegraph was supposed to be a government device that would be top secret, that would be used only by government operatives in order to combat this conspiracy. He later became convinced that abolitionism was a British conspiracy to destroy the Union. He was a defender of slavery, and as a Northerner, this was an unusual position to have. He was pretty alienated from his fellow Northerners during the 1850s and through the Civil War. He wanted to reconcile the North and South. He was appalled that the telegraph was an instrument used by the North in waging the Civil War. So his claims about the ways in which the telegraph would promote national unity and really international harmony are somewhat belied by his own particular political commitments and political paranoias.
Well, Professor Lepore, thanks so much for visiting with us.
Well, thank you.
I've been speaking with Joe Lepore, a professor of history at Boston University and the author of A is for American, Letters and Other Characters in the Newly United States.